welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is United States Congressman, a member of Congress, David Price. David, we think of you as our congressman in perpetuity, almost. I mean, it's you've shown that you can win election after election.
That sounds like I'm pretty old. I don't want to.
Well, you are pretty old. You're almost as old as I am, and so you're ancient. You're ancient.
But I'm closing now on 10 terms, so I guess that does qualify as a fairly senior member, although there are a lot of guys in the Congress who have been there longer than I have.
Yeah, but seniority has made a difference in your life, as well as something else that's made a difference from the last time that you and I talked, is that instead of being in the minority for a long time, and then last year about this time you were planning, you knew you were going to be in the majority. That is, that the Democrats would take charge and that some of the seniority that you developed would make a difference in terms of your role in committees. And you had some thoughts about what difference it would make. What have been the bright spots and the down spots of being a committee chair, subcommittee chair, and running things rather than chasing after other people?
Well, the combination of being more senior now and being in the majority has indeed made a big difference. It's very different from life in the Congress under Republican control, but it's also very different from life in the majority as a very junior member when I first came to the Congress, because
you were a junior member twice.
Well, I was a junior member under Democrats and a junior member under Republicans.
I guess that's right.
The Republicans, the way they ran the place, even if you weren't so junior, you feel like you were. And this is a big change. And I'm chairman of two things. One is an appropriations subcommittee, which is the all-absorbing assignment for me and my staff right now, the Homeland Security Appropriations Subcommittee. I'm also chairman of the House Democracy Assistance Commission, which I know we discussed earlier as well. This is the reincarnation of the group I worked with back in the 90s that worked with the emerging parliaments in Eastern Europe and the Soviet
spreading world. Representative government or in consultation with people who are participating in representative governments in other parts of the world.
That's right. Parliament to parliament. One of the justified criticisms, I think, of this administration and of our country's approach to democracy building is that we sometimes seem to think it's just about elections, when in reality what happens between elections is at least as important, and that usually means representative government, some kind of parliamentary body that may or may not be effective in representing the full array of views in society. So we're trying to reconstitute that effort that was so successful in Eastern Europe and that Newt Gingrich and others allowed to lapse. We've now reconstituted it. We still have some unfinished business in Eastern Europe with Macedonia, for example, and Georgia and Ukraine, but we're also working in other countries. So I'm chairman of that as well, and that's a labor of love on my part. I really do think that's important work and kind of a political scientist's dream. So I view that as very, very important. But there's no question that the main act for me and my staff has been trying to get hold of this new Department of Homeland Security and write a funding bill that not only funds the department, but also gives us some leverage on making the department work better.
Well, talk to us about what you found out in the last year about the Department of Homeland Security and what role a legislator, and a legislator who sort of has control of the funding of the agency, what kind of leverage does that give you to make a difference in the way the department operates?
Well, let me mention a couple of things, because this has not been a situation where I felt like we had to make a 180-degree turn. Appropriations, despite all the polarization and all the partisan excess, appropriations has remained one of the more bipartisan committees in the Congress. Now, as we fight over the budget endgame here, it might be hard to believe that. But still, the way the appropriations bills get put together initially is reasonably cooperative, and we reach across partisan lines. The staff is professional and is not highly partisan. And so this is an area where...
David, do you have a buddy on the Republican side? Would he be a co-chair? Would he be the ranking minority member on your committee? And
the former chairman, Hal Rogers of Kentucky, is a good friend. And he chaired the committee during its first 4 years. He's now the ranking Republican member.
So notwithstanding the great partisan differences in Washington, there are areas where you and your the senior colleague from the other party, you all can talk and work together and you take account of his views, he took account of your views, or is it a little bit strained?
Well, it's some of both. It's more strained than it used to be, but as I said, we wouldn't describe this as a 180-degree turn. We'd describe it as some significant changes, but trying to maintain the comity and the cooperative.
Well, give us some illustrations of what's been going on.
I'll give you a couple of examples. One is we've done a much more thorough job, I believe, of oversight of the department and of analysis, drawing on resources outside the department to help us get a handle on what's going on there and what can be done better. Before we even heard from Secretary Chertoff, for example, we had 2 weeks of hearings from the watchdog agencies, from the from outside analysts, from people who could help us prepare to ask the right questions, which is often half the game, you know, just knowing what questions to ask and what areas to probe. So as a result of that, we had 20 days of hearings. They were hearings that gave us some ability to write, I believe, a bill that will improve operations in one example would be in the area of analyzing risk. You know, you could dump the whole U.S. Treasury into this Homeland Security effort. There are many, many ways we could protect ourselves, hypothetically, and spend a lot of money. But you obviously can't do that. We have to set priorities. Moreover, it's no secret that this department has had trouble in particular with the natural disaster side of its portfolio. You know, for this administration, it's been all terrorism all the time. And they talk about FEMA and natural disaster preparedness and improving emergency operations, especially after Katrina. They've talked about that. But they really haven't done, I think, a very good job on that. And so we're asking the National Academy of Sciences to help us on this and to look at the way the department is analyzing risk and setting priorities and directing funding, and to say whether this is a coherent way of doing business. And in particular, are we making a mistake in kind of lumping together natural disasters and man-made terrorist incidents? Maybe those are so different, and the parts of the country that are most vulnerable are so different that we...
Two different departments?
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that, but maybe not one metric.
Or maybe move natural disasters back into something else.
Maybe, or maybe...
Or how do... I mean, you know, all these are great questions, but you've been thinking about it for a year.
Thinking about it, and we're determined to get a handle on it, and because we think...
Well, how long does it take to get... I mean, you've had a year. Seriously, you could study this thing
we're not talking about endless study. What we are talking about is getting some kind of critical handle on what we're doing. Let me give you a more practical example. Although this risk analysis is quite practical, it will make a difference, I think, especially in the way we assign funding to places in danger of natural disasters. Let me give you a more concrete example. The risk of some kind of biological incident.
Okay. You're talking about a terrorist biological incident rather than an epidemic of some sort.
Yeah. Yes, a man-made incident. We right now have what we call a BioWatch program underway, where we have stationary monitors set in supposedly high-risk areas that are designed to pick up the presence of an agent that is introduced into the atmosphere. And those stationary monitors are checked every now and then, checked quite frequently, actually. And so that's the way we would detect the presence of some kind of agent. Some people have looked at that and said, look, what if you did this instead? What if you had a vastly improved public health system where you were monitoring extensively any kind of unusual event out in the healthcare system so that an unusual cluster of cases or some kind of unusual diagnosis that was picked up and reported on immediately? Wouldn't that be a more effective and more efficient way of picking up trouble, getting an early sign of trouble than the BioWatch system? Moreover, this would have a dual use because this would not only help you pick up a terrorist attack, but it also would be relevant to epidemics and pandemics. And you know, I think that's a very serious question. And it's the sort of question that we should be getting some answers to before we just pour money indefinitely down both of those funding streams. So maybe that's an easier.
Yeah, I guess it is. Although, just let me, and that makes a lot of sense and puts this question maybe not in exactly the right perspective. But I'm trying to put myself in your shoes or in the shoes of the Secretary of Homeland Security, and to say that, as you pointed out, you could pour the whole Treasury into any of the efforts, either in preventing or responding to natural disasters or preventing or responding to outside or inside terrorist activities. And you put one person in charge of that, or you put a small group of people in charge of it, and say you got to do both of these assignments, and we got a limited amount of money, but you got to take care of both of them. Now, if you only have a limited amount of money and you got one of these assignments, then you can evaluate priorities easily within those within the area of homeland security as focused on terrorism, or homeland security is focused on responding to natural, preventing and responding to natural disasters. But when you're asked to do all of it, and just you get a, if you prepared for natural disasters, then the terrorist attack comes. If you prepared for terrorist attack, then the natural disaster comes and you shifted your resources. And you get, you know, you made the wrong decision almost in any case.
Well, one thing that should tell you, I think, is that there should be a bias in favor of dual-use technologies, something that will serve both purposes.
And you think you're arguing that in the majority of cases, dual-use or that developing monitoring capability can do both of these things. You can get stuff that monitors nuclear infiltration and at the same time looks out for hurricanes. I mean, that just doesn't.
Well,
that's not.
Well, to go back to the public health case, you could probably tell I would tilt toward a mm-hmm. public health-based system. It's been developed. Our state health director, Dr. Devlin, has been working on the development of this kind of network for some time now, and I think with some success. I think it's a major point.
In public health, in epidemic and biological terrorism, let public health give them the resources to monitor both of these and respond to both of them, will be well served, is sort of your argument on that.
That's a major argument in its favor, that it has mm-hmm. that kind of dual capability. Now, we'll still need to have stationary and handheld monitors that can detect bad stuff in the atmosphere. But does that make sense as a comprehensive strategy, having these things all over creation, these stationary monitors? That's the question we're asking. And are there not alternative models? But so at some point, you probably do have to make some choices.
Well, I'm talking to Congressman David Price. We're talking about his work and particularly his new responsibilities as the chair of the Appropriations Subcommittee. I got that right on Homeland Security. He and I'll be right back after this short break. Who's talking? This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Representative David Price, our U.S. Congressman from the 4th District, representing Chapel Hill and, well, a few other parts of the state as well.
and
a few suburbs of Chapel Hill. David, we've talked about the increased responsibilities that you have, and I think the thing that impresses me and many of your friends here is the passion and incredible work ethic that you put into the responsibilities that have been given you on a national basis. But what about does the change in your responsibilities make any difference as far as what goes on here in Chapel Hill, other than just that we live in a better country because you're helping frame our homeland security efforts?
Well, that since you put it that way, that's a steep hill to climb. But I actually wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think that that there were very specific effects for people living in our communities, including this community. The battle we're engaged in as we speak to pass the budget for the fiscal year that's already begun May look to some people like an exercise in green eyeshade number juggling, but there's a lot of there's a lot of human needs and ability to deal with those needs behind those numbers. Many people in this community recognize that. Somebody asked me the other day what has been the main thrust of the advocacy. The people have been coming up to Washington talking to us in recent weeks, and I would say health and health care and health research. There are many, many people in this community, and here I would include UNC and NC Central and Duke and NC State. This district is a major, major center of health research on all kinds of diseases and maladies that have plagued mankind for centuries, and we can be very proud of that. We can also, I think, fully appreciate just what folly it is to even think about cutting back on those research efforts. For one thing, they do enormous good. For another thing, they economically represent probably our greatest competitive advantage, the kind of research enterprise that we have in this country. And so that's...
So fighting in not only in the Homeland Security area, but in the overall budget area, to be sure that the that this perspective that you have, that is that investment in research is a winner for many reasons, you have to fight for that.
You have to fight.
Now, who are the enemies of that approach?
Well, there's no one who will say I'm opposed to
right.
research. But, you know, you have to ask what kind of priorities people set and the various players, and in this case, the administration budget is I think a totally inadequate budget, and we're struggling in the Congress. Frankly, even under Democratic control, we're struggling to do right by things like medical
sure.
research, because there are a couple of 800-pound gorillas in the room. It turns out, as you well know, one is the Iraq War, eating up hundreds of billions of dollars. And the other is the Bush tax cuts, which, you know, are a mixed bag. Some of them have had a good effect, but many of them have gone to the very wealthiest people in this country with very, very little economic stimulus effect. So, and that's also well over $1 trillion, as you look.
So everybody is right. in favor of research, but nobody would favor that, or a lot of people, you'd have to say we got to fund the troops first, or that we got to give these tax incentives to future growth. That's more important than
some people, I guess, would put it that way. I would I would say that of course we have to. You can't withdraw funding for troops in the field. On the other hand, we need to get this war turned around. We need to get our redeployment underway, and we need to turn Iraq over the best way we can to the Iraqis so that they can defend and govern themselves. So we need to wind that war down. We need to not just mindlessly extend all those tax cuts either. But I tell you, until some of those tax cuts expire and until that war begins to wind down, we are severely constrained in what we can do with this budget. So here's what we've done. We've found about $22 billion. That's in a $3 trillion budget. Somebody said that's like quarreling over $20 out of $3,000. We've found about $22 billion that we want to add to the president's budget request. Now, the president's actually cutting the budget, wants to cut the budget below what it would take to maintain current services in areas like health care and education. So we're actually raising the current services budget by only $5 billion. But anyway, it's as budgets go, it's not a huge amount of money, but it certainly is an important amount of money when you think about how it's targeted and where it would be applied. Two things like affordable housing and highways and Homeland Security. There's some differences on Homeland Security and veterans health. Veterans health is a big item. And health research. So these are important differences. What's underway right now, the reason we're going back in December to Washington, is to try to split the difference with the president and get the budget enacted so that we're on track here for this fiscal year. And I'm, of course, very hopeful that we can pull that off.
I don't think most of our neighbors understand the budget, the complicated budget situation that you find yourself in, and you describe it. So many budget bills, so many threats to veto, so many threats to go ahead and pass it anyway and let the president veto it on the appropriations bills, not just the other ones that there's disagreement about.
Well, I know people don't. It does make your head spin after a while. Mm-hmm. That's why I started out talking about this with reference to health research and the mm-hmm. kind of advocacy that's come out of this community from champions of disease research, research on one disease or another, or people actually doing the research, because it's a big mistake for those of us in government or for people who are in these ideological political battles. It's a big mistake to lose sight of the human importance of what you're dealing with. And in this case, the human importance is right there to see, right below the surface. It's going to make a difference whether we are able to do something like we're trying to do in continuing this children's health insurance program, for example. This SCHIP program, so-called, the children's health insurance program that has benefited so many kids.
Where does the S come from?
State children's.
And this is a program in which the federal government provides funds for states to run or to contributes funds to states who run a children's health program that supplements what might be a Medicaid program.
That's right. It's for the children where the family income is mm-hmm. just above the Medicaid level, but still in the category of.
Is there a lot of passion out there for this?
Yes, 82% of the American public favor a continuing.
Well, if somebody called me on the telephone and said, "Do you favor health care for children?" I'd say yes. But what for the money and the fight that's developed between the president's veto and the Congress's determination to get something like this passed is does the public understand it, and are they really on the Congress's side or the Democratic majority Congress's side, or is it just? And if so, why didn't the president take account of that?
Well, that's a good question, and it is. You're right. Of course, it's one thing to see 82% of the people mm-hmm. are for something. It's another thing to say they really care. Of course, it's one thing to say 18% of the people are opposed to something, and another to say they really care.
Right. Right.
I think the intensity on this issue is mainly on the side of those who do care, and who mm-hmm. who do care about reaching these children and providing health care. We have a lot of interest in this district, and certainly I feel like we've got the high ground on this issue. But you raise a very good question. Why does the president persist in vetoing something like this? And an equally good question, why do Republicans in Congress, not all of them by any means, but why does enough of the Republicans in Congress stick with the president on this for him to be able to veto it? Actually, if you fast forward a little bit to the Labor HHS Education Appropriations Bill, which is the one that has that health research money and that education money in it, there too the president has vetoed. But in that case, we came only two votes short of overriding the veto.
Well, is there any merit to the accusation that some people make that the Democratic political gurus or managers, the Democratic Karl Rose, say, hey, it's really good if we don't get this settled, because if we don't get this settled, we can beat the president up on an issue that's really people are for us. So let's don't make a compromise that he can take. Let's keep it out there. Is there any basis on which people could make that accusation?
Well, there is from time to time. You've probably heard the expression, I've heard it, that somebody would rather have an issue than a solution. And there are people on both sides, I dare say, who would sometimes rather have an issue than a solution.
Right.
But you know, it's not as clear-cut as it sounds, because let's just take that children's health insurance case. You ask what the president's up to, why would he veto it? I think it's Roveianism without Rove. I think he's playing to the to the conservative Republican base, just like all these Republican presidential candidates appear to be doing right now, and he's trying to rebrand relabel the Republican brand as being fiscally conservative, and he somehow seems to think that's going to pay off. I think as you see more and more Republicans in Congress voting to override these vetoes, I think that's up for
yeah.
question. But nonetheless, that seems to, at least at this point, be the be the calculation. But back to the business of having an issue rather than a solution. I'm asking myself, and I think our leadership is asking themselves, how far should we go? How far should we go in meeting the president on these matters? How much should we compromise? Do you reach a point with, let's say, the effort to cover $10 million under the 10 million children under the Children's Health Insurance Program? Can you, in good conscience, should you cut that back to 9 million, 8 million, 7 million? At what point do you say, yeah, I really would rather have an issue than to have that kind of solution? I'd rather, you know, let's say temporarily continue this program for a year and then fight another day. I'm just not going to get back down, but just so far. Now, that's a serious thing. It's not just political gamesmanship.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I'm not. I didn't mean to be. I'm always ready to argue myself, on, particularly when I think I've got the best side. Yeah. Well, I'm talking to Congressman David Pricey, and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is U.S. Congressman David Price. And David, we've been talking about policy, and it's always a treat to talk to you about policy because you're not only a congressman but an expert in the science of political science. And so policy is something that you're quite comfortable with, and it's great to have a representative who has that background. But there's another part of politics as well that, you know, that you also enjoy, I think, and that is election politics. And we're at the beginning stages still, I guess. You and I are following it. We've been following it. You know, we never stopped following it. It's a continuous kind of thing. But I guess you'd have to say that the presidential candidates are in the equivalent of late spring training right now, in the sense that the opening games are not that far away. And are you having a good time watching the presidential campaigns?
Well, you know, speaking of interesting conversations you and I've had in the past, I think we had a three-way conversation with Bill Luchtenberg maybe a year ago about the presidential nomination process. And I'm here to say that it's a disaster.
It's all these great plans that we had have. You ready to go back to the smoke-filled rooms of the 1948 conventions and
let somebody else write the rules? You know, we made a good try, I think, on the Democratic side, and I'm sure we don't want to get into this in too much detail. But we made a good try on the Democratic side to keep some of these early contests, but to diversify the mix of early contests, and then to spread out the contests within the regular season. And on both counts, all I can say is that we failed. We didn't fail for a lack of good intentions on our part. I think it was a sound plan. But we failed because many, many states want a place in the sun. And the product of each state struggling to find its place in the sun is really to give nobody a very effective place in the sun and to have a process that is paradoxical. I mean, you're right, of course, in saying that it's early. But, you know, it's also late.
Yeah, we're going to wake up one day in January, and the nominations are going to be settled. Yeah,
this thing is in one or both parties. This thing's going to be over in.
Well, back away from us. Yeah, back away in. As I said, I've credited you, and with it's genuine that you are an expert. So take off your congressman hat for a minute and put on your political prognosticator hat to the extent you can without compromising your ability to do that. And first, on the Republican side, how does those campaigns stack up as you see them now?
Well, I think what we were saying earlier about the Roveianism without Rove, it apparently has infected the Republican Party, and I don't think this must not be irrational. I mean, these guys probably have extensive polling information and other information that is informing the way they're campaigning. But as incredible as it seems, they're all actually to the right of George Bush, or they seem to be trying to get there to appeal to the most conservative elements in their party. You take a man like Mitt Romney, who has an interesting record as governor of Massachusetts, a progressive state. He put in place a health care plan in Massachusetts that approaches universal coverage, something that we know is important. But is he claiming credit for that? No, on the contrary. Mm. He seems to be backing away from it as fast as he
can. See, you're getting into policy rather than horse radars and all that.
No, all right.
But I would just say, I mean, it just raises with me in looking at you and the kinds of things you have to deal with here. You're sympathizing with the Republican candidates who have to get to the right of even George Bush in order to get the attention of their base. And I'm sitting across the table from David Price, who finds that, although he's characterized as being a moderate liberal in his home base, he's criticized because he won't impeach president. You know, he won't bring the impeachment articles or won't get us out of Iraq. So, you're not immune from the pressures to play to your base the same way these guys are playing to their right-wing base.
No, we're not immune, nor are the Democratic presidential candidates immune. But I would submit to you that playing to the base, to the ideological base, is far more advanced on the Republican side than it is among Democrats.
Well, playing to the base, and obviously they're doing it because their people tell them that that's the base that's going to be in the caucuses and in the primary voters. And so, who's going to win the Republican nomination?
It is a baffling.
If you had to bet today.
I'll make a prediction, but it is kind of strange because none of these guys are ideologically pure as far as I can tell. That's the irony of this, but yet they're all trying to prove just how orthodox they are. They seem to me to have pretty grave political flaws in each case, but I would say just by process of elimination, the one that I can see most clearly surviving the process would be Mitt Romney.
We know that you're not guaranteeing that, but that's a
and it is pretty much a process of elimination because I have a very hard time seeing the way clear for any of the others
to do it
to make it. In both parties, the early contests are going to be extremely important. I think in the Republican Party, the early contests will not be decisive. I think there'll be a scattering. And I think even February 5th may not be decisive. I mean, in the Republican Party, you really may have a divided, a splintered outcome that takes you pretty far into the season. I think on the Democratic side, that's probably less likely.
Let's take a quick break and come back and talk about the Democratic presidential contest. I'm talking to Congressman David Price, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Congressman David Price. And if you joined us late, David Price has given us a good reason to understand why he's doing such a good job as our congressman by talking about some of the important policy issues. And now I'm taking advantage of his political science training by trying to get him to explain what's going on in the presidential race. You've predicted that Mitt Romney ultimately is the most, in your judgment, based on today's factors, the more likely, by process of elimination, to be the Republican nominee. It's different on the Democratic side, and you have to be careful because one of the presidential candidates is a constituent of yours, I guess. Is that right?
I mean, I'm proud of the way he's conducting his campaign, John Edwards. I and the other Democrats in the North Carolina delegation have endorsed him and are trying to help in whatever ways we can.
Well, let me just interrupt.
Kind of prediction I made.
I'm going to let you hold off on the prediction. Hold off on the prediction because we got to talking about how playing to the base, the primary voter base, changes the way that, say, Mitt Romney approaches policy matters differently from what he did when he was governor of Massachusetts. And it's been interesting to me to watch John Edwards approach policy issues differently as a candidate running in a reasonably conservative North Carolina versus how he approaches it as a candidate running in a what you might call a left-leaning Democratic Party caucus-going and voting arena. Do you notice the same transformation as an aggressive advocate for the poor, for labor, for these kinds of things, or do you just say no? That's the way John started out.
No, I think there's been some change the way John presents himself and the way John runs in this presidential race and the previous one for that matter. To say nothing of the way he initially ran for the Senate. Some of that may be just an evolution in his own thinking. Some of it is no doubt a response to the kind of nationwide forces that he's dealing with and responding to, as opposed to what one faces in this state alone. There are some powerful threads of continuity. I think you mentioned the concern for poverty and for the dispossessed. That's a very consistent thing in John's record, I think, back in his pre-political days, as I say, nothing of his whole political career. So I give him high marks for a consistent passion on that issue. But as you say, on some other matters, like, for example, the war in Iraq, it's clear his views have evolved.
Well, let me just say, just put it in personal terms, that one of the, I don't want to accuse you of being insincere or anything, but one of the problems of being in North Carolina and representing this district, which tilts more liberal than other districts and other congressional districts, is that you, with your record, would have, you know, it would be a challenge to run statewide on your more liberal record than, say, Mike McIntyre might have. And so John Edwards would have the same problem coming back, wouldn't he, to run statewide in North Carolina after running nationwide in the Democratic Party primaries with the kind of positions. Can you get a question out of that you could respond to?
I think what you say is quite true, that he's now been in a different political arena, in a different environment, dealing with a whole range of different forces to come back into a more limited kind of situation, a more conservative place. Yes, of course, that would pose some...
Should Hillary be elected to the presidency, then John Edwards would have an easier time getting elected as senator from New York than he would reelect or getting elected again in North Carolina, wouldn't he?
I don't know. That's not just a matter of ideology, but
well, now they've proved that they will accept Southerners moving. People from Arkansas can move there and get elected. Well, why not people from North Carolina?
Listen, people from New York will tell you, you and I are both aware that Hillary Clinton has some polarizing effects and that there are questions about her electability. And by the way, John Edwards ranks very high on electability. Dealing with both Obama and Clinton. That's one of his main arguing points, I think. But, you know, you talk to people from upstate New York who have actually interacted with Hillary Clinton and have seen her in their communities. And she's done a remarkable job of winning over upstate New York.
So you wouldn't be afraid to have her leading the ticket in North Carolina? In North Carolina, you wouldn't be a little bit nervous yourself about another?
I'd be a little bit nervous because I know that there is this polarization that seems to surround her, and I would hope she could overcome that. And I guess I'm really posing a question whether the kind of winning over of upstate New York could apply to the nation, or would it be just overwhelmed by the media image and the things that she really can't directly deal with?
What do you think, and putting aside what your preferences might be, do you think she's going to be the nominee and that we'll know that by mid-January?
I feel like she's had a rough few weeks here it looked almost inevitable a month, 6 weeks ago, and it looks less inevitable now. I wouldn't be at all surprised if she, if you get a divided outcome on the Democratic side out of those four early contests.
And if we do, then it's a wide open contest, do you think?
Well, I guess I'd still say the odds are that February 5th produces a fairly tilted outcome. and probably the odds still favor Hillary Clinton. But I really think that's uncertain, and I certainly think it can be affected in very major ways by the way those early contests go.
Well, David Price, any possibility that you'll look to run for another office, or are you, as I said earlier, our congressman for the indefinite future?
I've been disabled by representing the triangle.
No.
It's just although it is a relatively progressive area, and believe me, I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that, for not having to pull my punches in the way
right.
that might be required by being in other environments. So I love this district and love representing. And I've invested a great deal, and the voters have invested in me to get to the place now where I am chairing these committees in the House, and I just feel like that's where I can do my best.
Well, we're grateful to you for your representation and for taking time to come talk to us about it. Our guest has been David Price. Thanks to all y'all for listening. Be back same time tomorrow.